President Trump tweeted yesterday that he's recommending the General Services Administration and his own team go forward with initial steps in the transition process. He followed that up by saying he's not conceding the election and pointing out that the GSA doesn't determine an official winner. His tweets come after Emily Murphy, head of the GSA, sent a letter to President-elect Biden saying the agency would make resources available for his transition team to start their work. Kathleen Dolan is professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. She's here to talk about what this all means. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, in a normal time, Kathy, I don't think the General Services Administration is a household word. Can you talk about its importance, its practical importance in a presidential transition?
Well, the practical importance of the GSA in all of this is that they control the money that comes from the federal government to the campaign of the president-elect so that that person and the campaign can start moving the transition elements forward, connecting people from the transition team to members of the government, starting to share information, office space, equipment, computers, all sorts of logistical things.
What did you make of the delay in this go-ahead from the GSA to start doing all that stuff?
Well, I think it was, you know, simply one more piece of an extraordinary election year in which, you know, as we have continued to see sort of norms and different accepted procedures violated, the head of the GSA, you know, seems in her letter yesterday to have believed that as long as some of the state recounts were moving forward and until all of the states had certified their elections, that she didn't have the sort of power or the authority to open up the transition process. You know, her interpretation of that is different than has been the interpretation of the various heads of the GSA at different points in our history. And it's clear, I think, that it was, you know, her delay was motivated from the same perspective as, you know, the motivation of lots of Republicans to not visibly antagonize the president by acknowledging his defeat at the polls.
So we have this decision from the GSA. We have, as you mentioned, more states certifying the results, including Michigan and Pennsylvania. President Trump says he's okay now with the GSA step going forward, but he says he's not conceding. He's still contesting the results. Are you seeing any inklings from those around the president himself, that they're getting closer to accepting the election results?
Well, you know, the president may not accept the election results, and, you know, quite honestly, he doesn't have to. I mean, his conceding the election is not a legal action. There's nothing that he has to do to accept the election. You know, the states are moving forward. Enough states have certified their election results now that President-elect Biden clearly has more than 270 electoral votes. So it is at some level irrelevant that Wisconsin is still being, you know, recounted and that we don't certify until December 1st. Arizona will certify on Monday, and that'll be the second to the last of the battleground states that have been contested to certify. And so there have been a sufficient number of votes certified that President-elect Biden is indeed the president-elect. Different states will continue to certify, and then we'll move on to the process of the beginning of the Electoral College process with state electors voting on December 14th. And all of this happens regardless of whether President Trump ever admits or accepts or acknowledges or concedes the election.
And briefly, Kathy, as we wrap up, I know there were concerns from people, especially in national security fields and in pandemic-related fields, that if we don't have a smooth transition, this could be a serious matter with serious consequences for life or death. What are you watching for to make sure those kind of critical areas have a smooth transition?
So you did point to the two most central. You know, certainly as we have what looks like a positive hope and a positive trajectory on a vaccine for COVID-19. You know, the Biden administration needs to be working now with the people who are trying to get in place some procedures for approval of the vaccines and ultimate distribution of the vaccines. And so we don't want a situation like that to have a kind of faulty handoff. The same with national security issues. Some observers have been worried that this sort of period of transition could always be a time when different systems in the country, or the different speaking of voices, might make us vulnerable to some conflict or some attack. And so I think for almost any administration, we want continuity, and we want sort of a smooth American government to be visible to the world, so that enemies don't try to take advantage of this.
Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, no problem.
Kathleen Dolan is professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. She was with us to talk about the latest on the presidential transition. Now, over the course of the weekend, the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, reported around 3 million travelers went through airport security checkpoints. We haven't seen numbers like that since the spring and the early days of the pandemic starting to take hold in this country at that time. This comes as the CDC and other public health authorities are urging Americans to not travel for Thanksgiving. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your view on flying right now? Have you recently flown? If not, what would it take, if you're someone who travels by air ever, to get you back in the air? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Laura Albert is a professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison, where she researches modeling and problem solving around issues of homeland security, disasters, and public services. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What is your response, first of all, Laura, to these numbers we heard reported by the TSA from this past weekend of traveling? You know, it's not going to be a normal Thanksgiving season, but a lot more people are flying than have been over the last few months.
Travel has definitely increased even this past week. Up until this weekend, there was only one day when the number of travelers going through checkpoints hit 1 million passengers, and that was in mid-October. Then things were just under a million for about the past month, and then this past weekend we saw an uptick with the holiday travel. Now, there's normally between 2 and 2.5 million travelers per day, so travel is down about 60% compared to where it was at this time last year.
Now, airlines, of course, are businesses. They need airfares to stay in business and keep their staff on site. But it's not, as the CDC is saying, this is not a great time to travel for health reasons. How do we balance the business interest and trying to stop the pandemic?
Sure. And that's tricky. The airlines have done a few things, and there's a lot of people that have to travel for a variety of reasons. And so it's good that we still have some flights going on. Airline travel is actually part of our critical infrastructure, so we want that part of our economy to be there in the long run. But you're right, we want fewer people to travel because that's an avenue for transmitting the virus, although the risk on airplanes is actually fairly low, and we can get into that. Mm-hmm. But really, it's the travel of people throughout the country that helps spread and seed the virus. It's really what they do when they get off the plane and maybe visit with others.
Can you talk about the on-plane experience, what we know about the safety when it comes to the coronavirus, and what airlines have tried to do to make it safer?
Yeah, we've learned so much these past few months, haven't we? And one of the big surprises is how infrequent the coronavirus is transmitted in transportation, both public transportation and on the airlines. You'd think there'd be a lot of super spreader events on the airplanes, but there really isn't. And what we've learned about how the virus gets transmitted, it's through particles in the air, the aerosols, as well as the large particles. One way to reduce the risk is to wear the masks, which is really effective with the large particles. And filtration is basically the solution to reducing the risk from aerosols. And airplanes have had great filtration for quite a long time. And some recent studies have suggested that it's really outstanding. It's basically the state of the art. Air filtration is equivalent to something you see in an operating room. And all the air gets filtered every 3 minutes. And that makes a huge difference. There have been some risks on flights, a few spreading events that have been large, about 12 to 15 people. And they've been people that have been sitting very close to somebody with the coronavirus. And it's really just mostly been on the long haul flights, the 10 to 15 hour flights. So this is good news for travelers, although I think it's great if people stay home from traveling and follow the CDC guidance.
How about airports, especially on holidays? I think of those long, say, security lines waiting to get in where you're standing next to the same bunch of people for many minutes, maybe half hour, maybe an hour if things are really going slowly. How big a concern is that?
I'm concerned. It's not negligible in the security checkpoints. I've studied aviation security a long time. Mm-hmm. One good piece of news is that the TSA made initial changes that were really meaningful. And with the low airport volume numbers, it allowed them to really implement things like social distancing, which would be hard if you had 2.5 million people coming through the checkpoint. So it gave the TSA agents a little bit of time to learn and master new procedures. There's a number of things they've done to reduce contact. Most of the risk isn't huge, but everything you can do to reduce the risk, these things layer on top of each other and actually make a meaningful difference. So one thing is the physical distancing in lines, which is hard to do when travel really returns, because these airport lobbies weren't really built for our long security lines, and people tend to get crammed in them in these small areas when the travel will return. But right now, passengers can wait in physically distant lines. There's also some plastic shielding. Passengers generally handle their own tickets now and do some of the scanning to reduce physical contact with TSA agents. And there's a lot more disinfecting of the security checkpoints in various areas.
We're talking to Laura Albert, professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. We're talking about airline travel, safety, and the pandemic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about travel safety, airline safety during the coronavirus pandemic? Have you flown yourself? Are you thinking about it? Are you going to fly over the holidays? If you're avoiding flying and you're somebody who usually does do it for travel or business, what would it take to make you feel safe flying? And if you work in the industry, for an airline at an airport, what are you seeing? What are you experiencing? Are you working much? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about air travel with Thanksgiving just around the corner. UW-Madison Professor of Industrial and Systems Engineering Laura Albert stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions about flying, about air travel during the pandemic. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Love to hear your thoughts, maybe your personal experiences. If you work in the industry, definitely like to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laura, we've talked about safety elements on the planes and airports, but you also referenced it maybe more about what we do when we get there, whether we travel by plane, train, or automobile. What are your concerns there?
Well, it's really, we know how the coronavirus gets spread. It's prolonged close contact indoors, typically. And a lot of times, especially when people are traveling during the holidays, it's to be with friends and family. And then you're looking at small groups or large groups of people in prolonged areas.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Larry is with us in Viroqua. Larry, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Larry?
I had. My daughter is going to be taking Amtrak from Seattle back to La Crosse next week, and I was wondering the safety of traveling by train. She is going to have a roomette, so she won't be in general seating.
Interesting. Train travel, Laura. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, on trains, you don't have the excellent filtration that you do on planes, but what we've been learning from public transportation, such as the subways, is that it's not as risky as you might think. In part, it's because maybe the doors open. There's a lot of mask usage now on these trains. And you're really looking at limited number of people you might be traveling with in a compartment and certainly in a room that really cuts down on the major sources of risk. The key is to, wear the masks. And a train is a prolonged amount of time to be spent with other passengers, and mask wearing is probably the number one thing to do.
Larry, thanks a lot for calling in. I wonder, Laura, I know whenever there's an airline crash, a disaster of any sort, the industry tries to learn lessons and apply them to the future. Are there things we've learned from past outbreaks, you know, the SARS and things like that of the past that have been useful in trying to react to COVID-19 when it comes to travel?
One thing that we learned is that, you know, it's reflexive that you might want to think about a travel ban, but they really have to be done very early on to make a difference. Otherwise, the virus will just spread and you're really only slowing it down, but not making a big difference. And that's counterintuitive, but it comes out of some of the math modeling work. So that's one thing that we've definitely learned from piecing things together. In some of these studies, they've looked at whether or not people actually got the virus on an airplane by doing some DNA studies to and have verified maybe some transmission has occurred. So that's all some of what we're studying right now.
Let's go back to our callers now. Michael is on the line in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hello. I have a friend that's a TSA agent down in Florida, in Orlando. And one of the things that I know that the press does not cover is the infection rate amongst the TSA agents. And it's basically kind of like covered up because of the tourist industry down there. And I know that he had a big problem with fellow team members, TSA agents that were infected. There was a bunch of them that went to a birthday party. There was 14 that got infected. Then it turned to 21. Then it came to 42. I have no idea what the rate is now. And it was kind of like kept a secret because
Michael,
they felt that.
I got you, Michael. Thanks a lot for calling in. And Laura, yeah, I guess I've been focusing on the passengers so far. What do we know about protecting the TSA workers and the airline workers and other people?
It's really critical to protect the TSA agents in this. By early April, 706 TSA agents had tested positive and 5 died. As of today, 3,164 TSA agents have tested positive. There are 604 current infections and 10 have died. Right, so this is really sad. I will say that it is posted publicly on the TSA website. You can check the latest numbers, and they do post it by airport. So you can look at the infections at any airport throughout the country. And this is fairly transparent by the TSA. It is really concerning. You see some of the outbreaks mirror that of the general population, which suggests that the TSA agents are, as the caller suggested, generally getting the coronavirus outside of the workplace. But they together will work in these security checkpoint lanes in fairly close proximity over a shift. And if you're around somebody for an hour or two, even with wearing a mask, if it doesn't have the best ventilation, it's possible that they can transmit this to their coworkers at the security checkpoint. They're only around air travelers for just a few minutes, but with other employees, they're around each other for much longer. It's definitely a concern. And as a traveler, I really value what the TSA agents do, and keeping them safe is a high priority for me as I travel. And looking forward over at checkpoint security in the next 5 or 10 years, I'd like to see some major changes, less labor-intensive screening by the agents to increase physical distance, of course. And we can do that maybe through biometrics. Time will tell. We have to make sure the devices work really well. But I do think there will be some long-term changes as a result of these infections.
So, Laura, as somebody who is obviously studying this and following this really closely, is there something you're looking at in the COVID story as it relates to travel and wondering, you know, why aren't people paying more attention to this? Why isn't the media asking me about this? Is there something that's kind of nagging at you?
I'm looking forward. As an engineer, I'm always looking to solve problems and thinking about where we want to be in the future. And so there hasn't been a lot of discussion about things like TSA PreCheck. One way to increase physical distancing and to protect these employees is maybe to enroll people. But of course, nobody wants to enroll in TSA PreCheck if you're not planning to do any travel. So there are, I think, some big policy issues that have been nagging at me. And, you know, how do we think about think about solving these big problems strategically using analytics and industrial engineering, maybe to come up with some better policy that will put us in a better position in the long run.
Are we going to, you know, put in a lot of policies after this pandemic? And I don't know. And it might not leave us ready for the next one because it transmits a little differently, or there's something unique about it that doesn't get covered. Do we overact? Do we overcompensate for the current crisis and miss the next one?
You know, I think a lot of viruses are transmitted through air, and some other things that we might do for the pandemic, like just reduce waiting times, is highly correlated with traveler satisfaction. So these are probably good things. They probably will just be really good in the long run. If we can find cost-effective ways to make travelers happy, this might cause them to return to travel earlier than they might otherwise.
And briefly, what are you watching for now as we enter what's usually peak travel season, I think?
You know, I know that travel will be up a little bit, but I hope it's not up by a lot when we see the final numbers, especially after Thanksgiving, because we might see a mirroring of that at Christmas time. That's something I'm definitely keeping an eye on.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to be here.
Laura Albert is a professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. We talked to her today about safety and security measures in the airline industry and how passengers, airlines, airports, the TSA are responding to the ongoing pandemic, especially with the holidays right here.